The first signs of the tension that would develop between father and son came when Franklin decided to sail from England without him on August 24, 1762. The very day the news of William's pending appointment appeared in the papers, and less than 2 weeks before his scheduled wedding. On September 4th, William married Elizabeth Downes at the fashionable St. George's Church on Hanover Square, without his father in attendance. A few days later, he went to St. James's Palace, where he kissed the ring of young King George III and received his royal commission. His father, who had rushed back to London from Flanders a year earlier to witness George III's coronation, was not there. Then William and Elizabeth sailed for New Jersey, leaving William's secret son, Temple, behind in England. With the cool detachment he could display toward his family, Franklin never expressed any sorrow or apologies for missing these momentous events in his son's life. In his parting letter to Polly Stevenson, on the other hand, he expressed great emotion and regret that she had not become his daughter-in-law. Writing from a wretched inn in Portsmouth, using the third person, he lamented that he once flattered himself that she might become his own in the tender relation of a child, but can now entertain such pleasing hopes no more. Yet, though his son had not married her, Franklin promised that his paternal love would be undiminished. With more emotion than he ever used in his letters to his real daughter, he bid Polly farewell. "Adieu, my dearest child, I will call you so. Why should I not call you so, since I love you with all the tenderness, all the fondness of a father?" Franklin's mission to London had produced mixed results. The dispute over taxing the proprietors had reached a compromise for the moment, and the end of the French and Indian War had calmed the larger disagreements over raising funds for colonial defense. Unresolved, however, was the underlying question of colonial governance. For Franklin, who saw himself equally as a Briton and an American, the answer was obvious. The powers of the colonial assemblies should evolve to mirror those of Parliament, and Englishmen, on either side of the ocean, should enjoy the same liberties. After 5 years in England, however, he began to realize that the Penns were not the only ones who saw things differently. On his voyage home, Franklin resumed his study of the calming effect of oil on water, this time with more disturbing metaphorical implications. The lanterns aboard his ship had a thick layer of oil that floated atop a layer of water. The surface was always calm and flat, so viewed from above it would seem that the oil had stilled the roiling water. But when the lantern was viewed from the side so that both layers could be seen, it became evident that, as Franklin recorded, the water under the oil was in great commotion. Even though oil could give the appearance of stilling turbulence, the water beneath the surface was still rising and falling in irregular waves. This underlying turbulence, Franklin realized, was not something that could easily be calmed, even by the most judicious application of oil. Chapter 9. Home Leave. Philadelphia, 1763 through 1764. The Peripatetic Postmaster. When William Franklin arrived in Philadelphia in February 1763, 3 months after his father's arrival, any tension between the two men quickly dissipated. He and his new wife stayed 4 days at Franklin's house, recovering from their frightful winter crossing. And then father and son set off for New Jersey. The local gentry came out in sleighs to escort them to Perth Amboy, a tiny village of 200 homes, during a driving snowstorm. After William took his oath of office there, they traveled to repeat the ceremony in the colony's other capital, Burlington, where the festivities concluded with bonfires, ringing of bells, firing of guns. In Philadelphia, Franklin's enemies were appalled that his son had won a royal appointment. But proprietor Thomas Penn, writing from London, suggested it might have a calming effect. "I am told you will find Mr. Franklin more tractable, and I believe we shall," he said. "His son must obey instructions, and what he is ordered to do, the father cannot well oppose in Pennsylvania." That would turn out to be wishful thinking, because Franklin, at least for the time being, saw a distinction between instructions issued by the proprietor and those issued by the king. Nevertheless, his first year back in America would be a peaceful one. He was indeed far more tractable about Pennsylvania politics, partly because he was less engaged by politics, and partly because he was less engaged by life in Pennsylvania. Always invigorated by travel and the pursuit of diverse interests, and clearly not wedded to the hearth and home he had forsaken for 5 years, Franklin left in April on a 7-month, 1,780-mile postal inspection tour that took him from Virginia to New Hampshire. In Virginia, he performed one of those acts of quiet generosity that led him to have, even in controversial times, more loyal friends than enemies. His partner as colonial postmaster, William Hunter, had died, leaving a destitute, illegitimate son. Franklin was asked by one of Hunter's friends to take care of the boy and oversee his education. It was a difficult assignment, and Franklin expressed some reluctance. "Like other older men, I begin in most things to consult my ease," he noted. "But I shall with pleasure undertake the charge you propose to me." With both an illegitimate son and grandson of his own, he was sensitive to the situation, and he noted that Hunter would have done the same for him. Franklin hoped that Hunter's death would mean that, after 24 years of service, he would become the sole postmaster in the colonies, as his original commission stipulated. That was not to be. Despite Franklin's ardent appeal to his superiors in London, Virginia's governor was able to secure the appointment of his secretary, John Foxcroft, as Franklin's new partner. Franklin's more collegial nature returned to the fore, and he forged a friendship with Foxcroft on his visit to Virginia. There was much work to be done. With Canada now part of the British Empire, they set up a system for extending mail delivery to Montreal. They also arranged for packet ships to the West Indies and for postal riders to travel at night. A letter sent from Philadelphia to Boston could receive a reply within 6 days, and a round trip to New York could be done within 24 hours, a service that seems remarkable even now. Foxcroft joined Franklin on a brief visit to Philadelphia, and then they left for New York and a tour of the northern post offices. Franklin ardently wanted Deborah to come. If she could learn to share his love for travel and curiosity about the world, he felt, she might even agree to accompany him to London some day. Not surprisingly, she again refused to be uprooted. She was as independent in her own way as he was in his. But their relationship was close enough that he gave her permission to open any mail he got from England, as it must give you pleasure to see that people who knew me there so long and so intimately retain so sincere of a regard for me. There was more than vanity involved. The letters might, he hoped, soften her resistance to visiting England. In Deborah's stead, he took their daughter Sally, then 19, on his tour. It would serve as her coming-out party. In New Jersey, they stayed with William and Elizabeth, who took them to formal parties as well as pleasant excursions to the countryside. Then they traveled by boat to Newport, where Sally had the pleasure, and it did indeed turn out to be that, of meeting her father's long-ago flirtation Katie, now Catherine Ray Green, a married mother of two girls. Never one to forget the women who had become parts of his extended family, he also exchanged letters with Polly Stevenson on the trip, noting that the tender filial regard you constantly express for your old friend is particularly engaging. Franklin dislocated his shoulder falling from his carriage, and Sally was willing to linger in Newport so that she and Katie could nurse him. But he was eager to press on to Boston. They stayed there for 2 months, Franklin living with his sister Jane Meekham and Sally with her cousins, who owned a harpsichord. "I would not have her lose her practice," Franklin explained to Jane, adding sweetly, "and then I shall be more with my dear sister." During much of his stay in Boston, Franklin was confined to the house. He had suffered another fall on a short trip to New Hampshire and once again dislocated his shoulder. With most of his Boston relatives now dead and his own stamina at age 57 diminished, his letters turned more reflective and less flirtatious. "I am not yet able to travel rough roads," he lamented to Katie. Nevertheless, he still harbored hopes of traveling to England again. "No friend can wish me more in England than I do myself," he wrote Strawn. "But before I go, everything I am concerned in must be settled here, as to make another return to America unnecessary." When he got back to Philadelphia in November, he would find it harder than ever to settle affairs in a way that would allow him a sedentary retirement in England. More ferocious political turmoil and 4 more crossings of the Atlantic lay ahead. Franklin's 7-month tour of the colonies, along with the time he had spent in England, put him in a unique position to play a role in the coming storms. As a publishing magnate, and then as a postmaster, he was one of the few to view America as a whole. To him, the colonies were not merely disparate entities. They were a new world, with common interests and ideals. During his postal trip, Franklin made plans and issued instructions for the construction of a new 3-story brick home on Market Street, just steps from the spot where Deborah had first spotted him as a runaway lad. Since their common-law marriage in 1730, they had lived in at least 6 rented houses, but never one that they owned. Now, for the first time, they would have room to enjoy all the finery they had acquired since Deborah had bought him his first china breakfast bowl, the harmonica and harpsichord, the stove and scientific equipment, the library and lace curtains. Was Franklin becoming domesticated? In some ways, despite his love of travel and sometimes distant relationship to his own household, the aging runaway had always been a rather domestic soul, wherever he had lived. He loved his junto and clubs, his regular routine, and the surrogate domestic arrangements he had made in England. He had also remained somewhat solicitous, even caring, about his wife and daughter, as well as his relatives, even as he indulged his wanderlust. Whether his new house was intended for his own enjoyment or mainly for that of his family was unclear, perhaps even to himself. But his love of projects led him to be deeply involved in all the details, down to the quality of the doorknobs and hinges. Despite what he had written Strawn, the conflict about which side of the ocean he would inhabit was still unresolved. Deborah, for sure, still had no desire to live more than a few hundred yards from where she had been raised. "My mother is so averse to going to sea that I believe my father will never be induced to see England again," William wrote in his own letter to Strawn. "He is now building a house to live in himself." Franklin had also flirted with the idea of getting a land grant in Ohio, looking west rather than east. By late in 1763, he was confessing to Strawn that he was baffled about where he would spend his remaining years. "We shall see in a little time how things will turn out." The Paxton Boys. Franklin's future plans would depend in part on the conduct of Pennsylvania's new governor, John Penn, who was a nephew of proprietor Thomas Penn, and had been a delegate with Franklin to the Albany Conference. Franklin was hopeful. "He is civil," he wrote to Collinson, "so I think we shall have no personal difference. At least, I will give him no occasion." The first issue that Penn and the Pennsylvania Assembly faced was frontier defense. The British victory in the French and Indian War had not fully secured peace with all of the Indians, and settlers in the West were being plagued by raids led by the Ottawa chief known as Pontiac. By the fall of 1763, the fighting had subsided, but not the resentments of many of Pennsylvania's rough-hewn backwoodsmen. These erupted on December 14th. When a mob of more than 50 frontiersmen from around the town of Paxton murdered 6 unarmed Indians, all of them peaceful, converted Christians. 2 weeks later, an even larger mob slaughtered 14 more Indians who had been harbored for their safety in a nearby workhouse. The Paxton Boys, as the growing mob of frontiersmen came to be called, declared that their next stop was Philadelphia, where more than 140 other peaceful Indians were being sheltered. They threatened to kill not only the Indians, but also any whites who protected them, including prominent Quakers. This provoked some Quakers to set aside pacifism and take up arms, and it led others to flee the city. The uprising threatened to become the most serious crisis Pennsylvania had ever faced, a full-fledged social and religious civil war. On one side were the frontiersmen, mainly Presbyterians, plus their working-class sympathizers in town, including many German Lutherans and Scots-Irish Presbyterians. On the other side were Philadelphia's old-line Quakers, with their pacifist proclivities and desire to trade with the Indians. The Quakers, despite being now easily outnumbered by the new German immigrants, dominated the assembly and repeatedly resisted spending much for frontier defense. For a change, Philadelphia's upper-class Anglican merchants, who tended to support the proprietors in their fights with the assembly, found themselves allied with the Quakers, at least temporarily. A virulent pamphlet war ensued. Philadelphia's Presbyterians, supporting their backwoods brethren, assailed the Quakers for coddling the Indians and refusing to allow the frontiersmen the proper representation in the assembly that was decreed in the charter. Franklin responded with his own pamphlet in late January 1764. Entitled A narrative of the late massacres in Lancaster County, it was among the most emotional pieces he ever wrote. He began his screed with poignant profiles of each of the Indians killed, which stressed their gentle personalities and used their English names. These poor, defenseless creatures were immediately fired upon, stabbed, and hatcheted to death, he wrote, describing the massacre in gory detail. The eldest Indian was cut to pieces in his bed, the others scalped and otherwise horribly mangled. Franklin went on to describe the second massacre 2 weeks later in even more horrid terms. Being without the least weapon for defense, they divided into their little families, the children clinging to their parents. They fell on their knees, protested their innocence, declared their love to the English, and that in their whole lives they had never done them injury. And in this posture they all received the hatchet. Men, women, and little children were every one inhumanly murdered in cold blood. To the Paxton boys, all Indians were alike, and there was no need to treat them as individuals. Whoever proclaimed war, their spokesman declared, was part of a nation and not with the whole. Franklin, on the other hand, used his pamphlet to denounce prejudice and make the case for individual tolerance that was at the core of his political creed. If an Indian injures me, does it follow that I may revenge that injury on all Indians? He asked. The only crime of these poor wretches seems to have been that they had a reddish-brown skin and black hair. It was immoral, he argued, to punish an individual as revenge for what others of his race, tribe, or group may have done. Should any man with a freckled face and red hair kill a wife or child of mine, by this reasoning, it would be right for me to revenge it by killing all the freckled, red-haired men, women, and children I could afterwards anywhere meet. To reinforce his point, he provided historical examples of how various other people, Jews, Muslims, Moors, blacks, and Indians, had all shown a greater morality and tolerance in similar situations. It was necessary, Franklin concluded, for the entire province to stand up to the Paxton boys as they prepared to march on Philadelphia and to bring them to justice. Ignoring the slight inconsistency in his argument, he warned of the collective guilt all whites would otherwise share. The guilt will lie on the whole land till justice is done on the murderers. The pamphlet would later damage Franklin politically, for it reflected his underlying prejudice against the German settlers, as well as his lifelong distaste for Presbyterian Calvinist dogma. He showed little sympathy for the grievances of the frontiersmen, calling them barbarous men who had acted to the eternal disgrace of their country and color. Though a populist in many ways, he was wary of the rabble. His outlook, as usual, was from the perspective of a new middle class, distrustful both of the unwashed mob and of the entrenched elites. On Saturday, February 4th, a week or so after Franklin's pamphlet was published, Governor John Penn called a mass meeting on the State House grounds as the Paxton boys headed toward the city. At first, he took a strong stand. He ordered the arrest of the mob leaders, deployed British troops, and asked the crowd to join the militia companies that Franklin and others were organizing. Even many Quakers took up arms, though most of the town's Presbyterians refused. At midnight on Sunday, the mob of 250 reached Germantown, just north of the city. Church bells pealed alarms, and amid the chaos, a surprising alliance was formed. Governor Penn, Franklin wrote a friend, did me the honor on an alarm to run to my house at midnight with his counselors at his heels for advice, and made it his headquarters for some time. Penn went so far as to offer Franklin control of the militia, but Franklin prudently declined. I chose to carry a musket and strengthen his authority by setting an example of obedience to his orders. Franklin and others, including many Quakers, wanted the governor to order an attack. Instead, Penn decided to send a delegation of 7 city leaders, including Franklin, to meet with the Paxton boys. The fighting face we put on and the reasonings we used with the insurgents, Franklin later recalled, restored quiet to the city. The mob agreed to disperse if they could send some of their leaders into town to present their grievances. As the tension with the Paxton boys receded, the antagonism between Franklin and Penn resumed. Franklin took a hard line. He wanted the governor and assembly, acting jointly, to confront the Paxton delegation together and hold them accountable for the massacres. The governor, however, realized the political advantage he could gain by forging an alliance with the Presbyterians and Germans who sympathized with the frontiersmen and who were offended by the harsh slurs Franklin had written about them. So he met with the Paxton delegation in private, listened to them courteously, and agreed not to press charges against them. He also, at their suggestion, instituted a policy of offering a bounty for any Indian scalps, male or female. Franklin was livid. "These things bring him and his government into sudden contempt," he wrote a friend. "All regard for him in the assembly is lost. All hopes of happiness under a proprietary government are at an end." The feeling was mutual. In a letter to his uncle, the proprietor Thomas Penn, Governor John Penn wrote an equally strong condemnation of Franklin. "There will never be any prospect of ease and happiness while that villain has the liberty of spreading about the poison of that inveterate malice and ill nature which is deeply implanted in his own black heart." A darkness had indeed begun to infect Franklin's usually optimistic heart. Feeling confined by Philadelphia and its foul politics, restless at home, and finding few scientific or professional diversions, he lost some of his amused, wry demeanor. His letters contained harsh rather than humorous assessments of politics, and even gloomier personal passages. To the medical doctor John Fothergill, a Quaker friend living in London, Franklin wrote, "Do you please yourself with the fancy that you are doing good? You are mistaken. Half the lives you save are not worth saving as being useless, and almost the other half ought not to be saved as being mischievous." Fighting the proprietors again. And so the fights between governor and assembly resumed, more heated than ever. They clashed over control of militia appointments, a lighthouse, and, of course, taxes. When the assembly passed a bill taxing the proprietors' estates, which followed the general outline but not the precise formula of the Privy Council compromise, Franklin wrote a message from the assembly to the governor warning that the consequences of vetoing the bill will undoubtedly add to that load of obloquy and guilt the proprietary family is already burdened with and bring their government into, if possible, still greater contempt. The governor vetoed it. At stake was not just principle, but power. Franklin realized that the proprietary party, now had strong support from the frontiersmen and their Scots-Irish and German kinsmen. That reignited his resolve to continue pursuing, against all odds, his dream of convincing the British to revoke the proprietor's charter and make Pennsylvania a crown colony. Most people in Pennsylvania still did not share his fervor for a royal rather than proprietary government. The members of Philadelphia's merchant aristocracy were friends with the Penns. The Presbyterian frontiersmen and ethnic working class had forged a new alliance after the Paxton Boys affair. Plus, they feared a royal takeover would bring the official establishment of the Church of England, which their dissenting families had fled. Even many prominent Quakers, such as Isaac Norris and Israel Pemberton, who tended to be Franklin's allies, were leery of a new charter that might remove some of the religious liberties that the late William Penn had secured long ago. With his stubborn crusade, Franklin was succeeding in dividing his friends and uniting his enemies. Likewise, in London, there was no more support for a royal takeover than there had been when Franklin began his crusade as an agent there. Lord Hyde, Franklin's boss at the British Postal Department, wrote that even those royal ministers who might like to get their hands on the colony were not willing to take on the Penn family. He publicly warned Franklin, a royal appointee, that all officers of the crown are expected to assist government. Franklin made a little joke of the warning, noting that he would not be hidebound. Nevertheless, Franklin still enjoyed effective control of the assembly, and in March 1764 he pushed through a series of 26 resolutions, a necklace of resolves, he called them, calling for the end of proprietary government. The proprietors, he wrote, had acted in ways that were tyrannical and inhuman. They had used the Indian threat to extort privileges from the people with the knife of savages at their throat. The final resolution declared that the assembly would consult citizens as to whether a humble address should be sent to the king, praying that he would be graciously pleased to take the people of this province under his immediate protection and government. The result was a petition drive asking for the ouster of the proprietors. Franklin printed copies in English and German, and even created a slightly different version for the Quaker community. But his supporters could garner merely 3,500 signers. Opponents of the change were eventually able to come up with 15,000 on their own petitions. Once again, a pamphlet war broke out. Franklin's contribution, Cool Thoughts on the Present Situation, was more heated than its title implied. He was not, at least for now, detached enough to employ his old tools of humor, satire, indirection, and gentle wryness in argument. His pamphlet attacked the proprietors for truckling to the Paxton Boys, and for being unable to manage the colony. "Religion has happily nothing to do with our present differences, though great pains is taken to lug it into the squabble," he wrote, not altogether correctly. "In any case," he continued, "the crown, rather than the proprietors, was most likely to protect religious liberties." Franklin's newest opponent was John Dickinson, a young lawyer who was the son-in-law of the great Quaker eminence Isaac Norris. Dickinson had been a friend of Franklin's, and no great fan of the proprietors, but he rationally argued that the safeguards of the Penn Charter should not be lightly abandoned, nor should it be assumed that the royal ministers would be more enlightened than the proprietors. Norris, unwilling to be caught in the crossfire, feigned sickness and resigned as Assembly Speaker in May. Franklin was elected to the post. Franklin also faced a more vitriolic older opponent, Chief Justice William Allen, who had also once been a friend, but whose ardent support of the proprietors had long ago led to a bitter break. When Allen returned from a trip to England in August, Franklin paid him a visit as an overture. In front of other guests, Allen denounced his assault on the proprietors. A switch to a royal government, he said, would cost Pennsylvania £100,000, and it had no support in London. As the October 1st Assembly elections neared, the pamphlet war turned vicious, as Franklin's foes sought to thwart his bid for re-election. One anonymous offering entitled, "What is sauce for a goose is also sauce for a gander," raked up every possible allegation against Franklin, most notably that his son William was the bastard child of a kitchen wench named Barbara. It also reprinted, and embellished a bit, various anti-German passages Franklin had written earlier. And it accused him, falsely but vociferously, of buying honorary degrees, seeking a royal governorship for himself, and stealing his electricity experiments from other scientists. Another broadside painted him as an excitable lecher. Franklin, though plagued with fumbling age, needs nothing to excite him, but is too ready to engage when younger arms invite him. Modern election campaigns are often criticized for being negative, and today's press is slammed for being scurrilous. But the most brutal of modern attack ads pale in comparison to the barrage of pamphlets in the 1764 Assembly election. Pennsylvania survived them, as did Franklin, and American democracy learned that it could thrive in an atmosphere of unrestrained, even intemperate, free expression. As the election of 1764 showed, American democracy was built on a foundation of unbridled free speech. In the centuries since then, the nations that have thrived have been those like America that are most comfortable with the cacophony and even occasional messiness that comes from robust discourse. Election Day was as wild as the pamphlets. Throngs of voters clogged the statehouse steps throughout the day of October 1st, and the lines remained long, well past midnight. Franklin's supporters were able to force the polls to stay open until dawn as they roused anyone they could find who had not yet voted. It was a tactical mistake. The proprietary party sent workers up to Germantown to round up even more supporters. Franklin finished 13th out of 14 candidates vying for the 8 seats in Philadelphia. His faction, however, kept control of the Assembly, which promptly voted to submit to the British ministers the petition against the proprietors. And as a consolation prize that was perhaps better than a victory, it voted 19-11 to send Franklin back to England as an agent to present it. That prompted a new flurry of pamphlets. Dickinson declared that Franklin would be ineffectual because he was hated by the Penns, disdained by the King's ministers, and extremely disagreeable to a very great number of the serious and reputable inhabitants of Pennsylvania. Chief Justice Allen labeled him the most unpopular and odious name in the province, delirious with rage, disappointment, and malice. But now that he was heading back to England, Franklin's even temper started to return. "I am now to take leave," perhaps a last leave of the country I love," he wrote in response. "I wish every kind of prosperity to my friends, and I forgive my enemies." Once again, his wife declined to accompany him to England, nor would she permit him to take their daughter. So why was he so willing to leave home again? Partly because he missed London, and partly because he felt depressed and confined by Philadelphia. There was also a loftier reason. Franklin had been developing a vision of an American future that went beyond even wresting Pennsylvania from the proprietors. It involved a greater union among the colonies, along the lines of his Albany plan, and a more equal relationship between the colonies and the mother country as part of a greater British Empire. That could include, he suggested, representation in Parliament. Responding to reports that Britain might propose taxes on the colonies, he wrote to Richard Jackson, whom he had left behind in London as Pennsylvania's other agent, a suggested response. "If you choose to tax us, give us members in your legislature, and let us be one people." As he prepared to leave for England in November 1764, Franklin wrote a letter to his daughter. It included paternal exhortations to be dutiful and tender towards your good mama, and typical Franklin advice, such as to acquire those useful accomplishments, arithmetic and bookkeeping. But it also contained a more serious note. "I have many enemies," he said. "Your slightest indiscretions will be magnified into crimes, in order the more sensibly to wound and afflict me. It is therefore the more necessary for you to be extremely circumspect in all your behavior, that no advantage may be given to their malevolence." He also had many supporters. More than 300 cheered him as he left Philadelphia for his ship. Cannons were fired as a send-off, and a song was sung to the tune of "God Save the King," with the new ending, "Franklin, on thee we fix, God save us all." He told some friends that he expected to be gone only a few months, others that he might never return. It is not clear which prediction, if either, he truly believed. But as it turned out, neither proved correct. Chapter 10. Agent Provocateur. London, 1765 through 1770. An extended family. Mrs. Stevenson was out when Franklin arrived, unannounced, at his old home on Craven Street, and her maid did not know where to find her. "So I sat me down and waited her return," Franklin recalled in a letter to her daughter Polly. "She was a good deal surprised to find me in her parlor." Surprised, perhaps, but prepared. His rooms had been left vacant, for his English friends and surrogate family had no doubt he would some day return. It would be just a short visit, he led his real wife, and perhaps even himself, to believe. He wanted to be back home by the end of the summer, he wrote Deborah soon after his arrival. "A few months, I hope, will finish affairs here to my wish, and bring me to that retirement and repose with my little family." She had heard that many times before. He would, in fact, never see her again. Despite her pleas and declining health, he would continue his increasingly futile mission for more than 10 years, right up to the eve of the Revolution. That mission involved complex balancing acts that would test all of Franklin's wiles. On the one hand, he was still a committed royalist who wanted to stay in favor with the king's ministers in order to wrest Pennsylvania from the hated Penns. He also had personal motives, protecting his postmastership, perhaps achieving an even higher appointment, and pursuing his dream of a land grant. On the other hand, once it became clear that the British government had little sympathy for colonial rights, he would have to scramble to re-establish his reputation as an American patriot. In the meantime, Franklin had the pleasure of settling back into the life he loved in London. Sir John Pringle, the distinguished physician, had become his best friend. They played chess, made the rounds to their regular coffeehouse clubs, and soon got into the habit of taking summer trips together. The great Samuel Johnson biographer, James Boswell, was another acquaintance. After dropping in on one of their chess games, Boswell noted in his journal that Pringle had a peculiar, sour manner, but that Franklin was, as always, all jollity and pleasantry. Franklin and Mrs. Stevenson resumed their relationship of domestic convenience, and Polly, still living with an aunt in the countryside, remained an object of Franklin's paternal affection and intellectual flirtation. He picked Polly as his first potential convert to a new phonetic alphabet that he had invented in a quixotic quest to simplify English spelling. It is easy to see why it did not catch on. "Consider chis alphabet, and give me instances of sich endless words and sounds as you me hink cannot perfectly be expressed by it," went one of his more comprehensible sentences. After a long reply that is near impossible to translate, in which she half-heartedly says the alphabet might be of service, she lapses into standard English to conclude, "With ease and with sincerity, I can, in the old way, subscribe myself." It was a measure of their intellectual bonding that Polly would indulge this linguistic fantasy as faithfully as she did. Franklin's phonetic reform showed little of his usual regard for utility, and it took his passion for social improvement to radical extremes. It required the invention of 6 new letters for which there were no printing fonts, and it dropped 6 other letters that Franklin considered superfluous. Answering Polly's many objections, he insisted that the difficulty in learning the new spellings would be overcome by the logic behind them, and he dismissed her concerns that the words would be divorced from their etymological roots and thus lose their power. But he soon gave up the endeavor. Years later, he turned his scheme over to Noah Webster. The famed lexicographer reprinted Franklin's letters to Polly in his 1789 book, Dissertations on the English Language, which he dedicated to Franklin, and called the project deeply interesting, but added, "Whether it will be defeated by insolence and prejudice remains for my countrymen to determine." Franklin brought his grandson, Temple, the illegitimate son of his own illegitimate son, out of anonymity and into his odd domestic orbit on Craven Street. The relationship was weird even by Franklin family standards. The boy, who was 4 when Franklin re-established contact, had been cared for by a series of women who sent itemized bills for his expenses, haircuts, inoculations, clothes, to Mrs. Stevenson, who then sought reimbursement from William in New Jersey. In all of his letters to Deborah at the time, filled with details of various friends and acquaintances, Franklin never mentioned Temple. But by the time the boy turned 9, William was asking, in a quite cowardly way, whether his son could be brought to live with him in America. He might then take his proper name and be introduced as the son of a poor relation, for whom I stood godfather and intended to bring up as my own. Foreshadowing a later struggle for the boy's allegiance, Franklin instead took him under his own wing. On Craven Street, he was known merely as William Temple, and Franklin enrolled him in a school run by William Strawn's brother-in-law, an eccentric educator who shared Franklin's passion for spelling reform. Even though Temple became part of the extended Stevenson family, they pretended, at least publicly, to be unaware of his exact provenance. As late as 1774, in a letter describing a wedding in which he was an usher, Polly would refer to him as Mr. Temple, a young gentleman who is at school here and is under the care of Dr. Franklin. Not until later, after Franklin and his grandson returned to America and Temple took up his true last name, did Polly confess that she suspected all along that there was some relationship. "I rejoiced to hear he has the addition of Franklin to his name, which I always knew he had some right to." The Stamp Act of 1765. Back in Philadelphia, Franklin was still seen as a tribune of the people and a defender of their rights. When word finally reached there in March 1765 of his safe arrival in London, bells were rung almost all night. His supporters ran about like madmen, and copious quantities of libations were drunk to his health. But their joy would be fleeting. Franklin was about to become embroiled in a controversy over the notorious Stamp Act, which would require a tax stamp on every newspaper, book, almanac, legal document, and deck of cards. It was the first time that Parliament had proposed a major internal tax on the colonies. Franklin believed that Parliament had the right to impose external taxes, such as duties and tariffs, to regulate trade. But he thought it unwise, perhaps even unconstitutional, for Parliament to levy an internal tax on people who had no representation in that assembly. Nevertheless, he did not fight the Stamp Act proposal with much vigor. Instead, he tried to play conciliator. He and a small group of colonial agents met in February 1765 with George Grenville, the Prime Minister, who explained that the high cost of the Indian Wars made some tax on the colonies necessary. What was a better way to levy it? Franklin argued that it should be done in the usual constitutional way, which meant by a request from the king to the various colonial legislatures who alone had the power to tax their own inhabitants. Would Franklin and his fellow agents, Grenville asked, be able to commit that the colonies would agree to the proper amount and how to apportion it among themselves? Franklin and the others admitted that they could make no firm commitment. Franklin offered another alternative a few days later. It stemmed from his long-standing desire, both as a rather sophisticated economic theorist and as a printer, to have more paper currency circulating in America. Parliament, he proposed, could authorize new bills of credit that would be issued to borrowers at 6% interest. These paper bills would serve as legal tender and circulate like currency, thus increasing America's money supply, and Britain would collect the interest instead of levying direct internal taxes. It will operate as a general tax on the colonies, and yet not an unpleasing one, said Franklin. The rich, who handle most money, would in reality pay most of the tax. Grenville was, in Franklin's words, besotted with his stamp scheme, and dismissed the idea. This may have been fortunate for Franklin, as he later heard that even his friends in Philadelphia disliked his paper credit idea as well. When the Stamp Act passed in March, Franklin made the mistake of taking a pragmatic attitude. He recommended that his good friend John Hughes be appointed the collection officer in Pennsylvania. "Your undertaking to execute it may make you unpopular for a time, but your acting with coolness and steadiness and with every circumstance in your power of favor to the people will by degrees reconcile them," he mistakenly argued in a letter to Hughes. "In the meantime, a firm loyalty to the crown and faithful adherence to the government of this nation will always be the wisest course for you and I to take, whatever may be the madness of the populace." In his desire to remain on decent terms with the royal ministers, Franklin badly underestimated the madness of the populace back home. Thomas Penn, on the other hand, played the situation cleverly. He refused to offer his own candidate for stamp collector, saying that if he did so, the people might suppose we were consenting to the laying this load upon them. John Dickinson, Franklin's young adversary as the leader of the proprietary party in the assembly, drew up a declaration of grievances against the Stamp Act that resoundingly passed. It was one of Franklin's worst political misjudgments. His hatred of the Penns blinded him to the fact that most of his fellow Pennsylvanians hated taxes imposed from London more. "I took every step in my power to prevent the passing of the Stamp Act," he claimed unconvincingly to his Philadelphia friend Charles Thompson, "but the tide was too strong against us." He then went on to argue the case for pragmatism. "We might well have hindered the sun setting. That we could not do. But since it is down, my friend, and it may be long before it rises again, let us make as good a night of it as we can. We may still light candles." The letter, which became public, was a public relations disaster for Franklin. Thompson replied that Philadelphians, rather than being willing to light candles, were ready to launch the works of darkness. By September, it was clear that this could include mob violence. "A sort of frenzy or madness has got such hold of the people of all ranks that I fancy some lives will be lost before this fire is put out," a frightened Hughes wrote the man who had gotten him what had become an unenviable job. Franklin's printing partner, David Hall, sent a similar warning. "The spirit of the people is so violently against everyone they think has the least concern with the stamp law," he wrote. Angry Philadelphians had imbibed the notion that you had a hand in the framing of it, which has occasioned you many enemies. He added that he would be afraid for Franklin's safety if he were to return. A cartoon printed in Philadelphia showed the devil whispering in Franklin's ear, "Thee shall be agent, Ben, for all my dominions." The frenzy climaxed one evening in late September 1765, when a mob gathered at a Philadelphia coffee house. Leaders of the rabble accused Franklin of advocating the Stamp Act, and they set out to level his new home along with those of Hughes and other Franklin supporters. "If I live until tomorrow morning, I shall give you a farther account," Hughes wrote in a log he later sent Franklin. Deborah dispatched their daughter to New Jersey for safety. But ever the homebound stalwart, she refused to flee. Her cousin Josiah Davenport arrived with more than 20 friends to help defend her. Her account of that night, while harrowing, is also a testament to her strength. She described it in a letter to her husband. "Toward night, I said Cousin Davenport should fetch a gun or two, as we had none. I sent to ask my brother to come and bring his gun. Also, we made one room the magazine. I ordered some sort of defense upstairs, as I could manage myself. I said when I was advised to remove that I was very sure you had done nothing to hurt anybody, nor I had not given any offense to any person at all, nor would I be made uneasy by anybody, nor would I stir." Franklin's house and his wife were saved when a group of supporters, dubbed the White Oak Boys, gathered a force to confront the mob. If Franklin's house was destroyed, they declared, so too would be the homes of anyone involved. Finally, the mob dispersed. "I honor much the spirit and courage you showed," he wrote Deborah after hearing of her ordeal. "The woman deserves a good house that is determined to defend it." The Stamp Act crisis sparked a radical transformation in American affairs. A new group of colonial leaders, who bristled at being subservient to England, were coming to the fore, especially in Virginia and Massachusetts. Even though most Americans harbored few separatist or nationalist sentiments until 1775, the clash between imperial control and colonial rights was erupting on a variety of fronts. Young Patrick Henry, 29, rose in Virginia's House of Burgesses to decry taxation without representation. "Caesar had his Brutus, Charles I his Cromwell, and George III," he was interrupted by shouts of "treason" before he could finish. But it was clear that some colonists were becoming deadly serious. Soon he would find an ally in Thomas Jefferson. In Boston, a group that would take the name the Sons of Liberty met at a distillery and attacked the homes of the Massachusetts Tax Commissioner and Governor Thomas Hutchinson. Among the rising patriots there, who would eventually become rebels, were a young merchant named John Hancock, a fiery agitator named Samuel Adams, and his sour lawyer cousin John Adams. For the first time since the Albany Conference of 1754, leaders from different parts of America were galvanized into thinking as a collective unit. A Congress of 9 colonies, including Pennsylvania, was held in New York in October. Not only did it urge the repeal of the Stamp Act, it denied the right of Parliament to levy internal taxes on the colonies. The motto they adopted was the one Franklin had written as a cartoon caption more than a decade earlier, as he sought to rally unity at Albany: "Join or die." From his distance in London, Franklin was slow to join the frenzy. "The rashness of the assembly in Virginia is amazing," he wrote Hughes. "I hope, however, that ours will keep within the bounds of prudence and moderation." For the time being, he was still more in sympathy with Governor Hutchinson of Massachusetts, later a great enemy. Both were reasonable men appalled by mob rule, and in this case threatened by it. "When you and I were at Albany 10 years ago," Hutchinson wrote him, "we did not propose a union for such purposes as these." Franklin's moderation was due in part to his temperament, his love of Britain, and his dreams of a harmonious empire. It was in his nature to be a smooth operator rather than a revolutionary. He liked witty discussion over Madeira, and he hated disorder and mob behavior. The fine wines and meals contributed not only to his gout, but also to his blurred vision about the animosity that was building back home. Perhaps more important, he was making one last attempt to turn Pennsylvania into a royal rather than proprietary colony. It was always an unlikely quest, now all the more so because of the turmoil over the Stamp Act, which made royal rule less popular in Pennsylvania and made colonial pleadings less popular in London. In November 1765, a year after Franklin's arrival and just as he was absorbing the damage done to his reputation by his waffling over the Stamp Act, the Privy Council officially deferred action on the anti-Penn petition he had brought. Franklin initially believed, or at least publicly professed, that this was merely a temporary setback. But he soon came to realize that Thomas Penn was correct when he wrote to his nephew, Governor John Penn, that the action meant the issue was dead forever. Spin Cycle. By the end of 1765, with his reputation as a defender of colonial rights in tatters because of his equivocation over the Stamp Act, Franklin faced one of the great challenges in the annals of political damage control. He began with a letter-writing campaign. To his partner David Hall and others, he strongly denied that he had ever supported the act. He also had prominent London Quakers write on his behalf. "I can safely aver that Benjamin Franklin did all in his power to prevent the Stamp Act from passing," John Fothergill wrote a Philadelphia friend. "He asserted the rights and privileges of America with the utmost firmness." Hall reprinted the letter in the Pennsylvania Gazette. Franklin felt the best way to force repeal, one that appealed to his Poor Richard penchant for frugality and self-reliance, was for America.